Welcome to the Redemption Church Podcast, located in Seattle, Washington. As a church, we are a community striving to be faithfully present to God, self, and others. We hope this is an encouragement to you in your life, no matter where you are. Thanks for joining us.
I'll be reading from Micah 5, if you'd like to read along. Now, muster your troops, O daughter of troops. Siege is laid against us. With a rod, they strike the judge of Israel on the cheek. But you, O Bethlehem Ephratah, you who are too little to be among the clans of Judah, from you shall come forth for me one who is to be ruler in Israel, whose coming forth is from of old, from ancient days. Therefore, he shall give them up until the time when she who is in labor has given birth. Then the rest of his brothers shall return to the people of Israel, and he shall stand and shepherd his flock in the strength of the Lord, in the majesty of the name of the Lord his God. They shall dwell secure, for now he shall be great to the ends of the earth. He shall be their peace. When the Assyrian comes into our land and treads in our places, then we will rise against him, 7 shepherds and 8 princes of men. They shall shepherd the land of Assyria with the sword and the land of Nimrod at its entrances. And he shall deliver us from the Assyrian when he comes into our land and treads within our border. Then the remnant of Jacob shall be in the midst of many peoples, like dew from the Lord, like showers on the grass, which delay not for a man, nor wait for the children of man. And the remnant of Jacob shall be among the nations, in the midst of many peoples, like a lion among the beasts of the forest, like a young lion among the flocks of sheep, which when it goes through, treads down and tears in pieces, and there is none to deliver. Your hand shall be lifted up over your adversaries, and all your enemies shall be cut off. And in that day, declares the Lord, I will cut off your horses from among you and will destroy your chariots. And I will cut off the cities of your land and throw down all your strongholds. And I will cut off sorceries from your hand, and you shall have no more tellers of fortunes. And I will cut off your carved images and from your pillars from among you, and you shall bow down no more to the work of your hands. And I will cut out your Asherah images from among you and destroy your cities. And in anger and wrath, I will execute vengeance on the nations that did not obey. This is the word of the Lord.
We're talking this morning on God's control and sovereignty, and I have none. I have none. I could have a microphone all morning long, and it doesn't matter, because you do what you want, and you vote with your feet, and I'm glad it takes you forever to sit down. It's good to greet one another. I don't know how you guys feel about the mass, but it feels pretty good. It feels pretty good to see your faces, regardless of where you're at on that issue. It's good to see the cases dropping. It's good to feel a little bit better about that. So, some semblance of normalcy. Let's jump into Micah 5. This is a really fun text. I'll admit, when I first read it, I had no idea where I was going to go. In fact, I told the staff where I thought I was going to go Monday morning, and I went in an entirely different direction. It's a really interesting text, but I think it's very relevant to us, especially living here in Seattle, as followers of God, and I think it will be very helpful for us. So if you have your Bibles or your apps, turn to Micah 5. I'm going to spend a lot of time, just so you know where I'm going, I always like to have a map. I'm going to spend a heck of a lot of time on verse 1 and verse 2, and then I'm going to move pretty quickly through the rest of it, 3 through 15, because I think it's helpful, but I think the meat of the text is honestly in the first two verses, so I'll just let you know that's, you know, there's 6 pages of notes, most of them are on 1 and 2, and then we'll wrap it up so you have an idea of how we think it might apply to us here in Seattle. So Micah chapter 5, first verse, it says this from the prophet Micah. Now muster your troops, O daughter of troops. Siege is laid against us. And with a rod they strike the judge of Israel on the cheek. This term daughter is common to a city. If you scroll up or if you flip back in your Bible, you'll note that he's talking about the city of Jerusalem. And the use of the term daughter was a term of intimacy and respect. It's a closeness. Jerusalem is the center of power in the southern kingdom. And so he's trying to be intimate with his language. He says, a daughter of troops, a siege is laid against us. Again, talking about Jerusalem. The benefit of reading prophecy in 2022 is they get to be on the back end of it. Because I can imagine that Micah's audience might not have known exactly what he was talking about. Is this really going to come to fruition? What might happen with this? But in 2022, we just get to flip over to 2 Kings and we can find out exactly what happened, exactly what went on. What is it that Micah's talking about? Well, we know. A siege is going to be laid. A rod will strike the judge of Israel. What would that possibly look like? So flip over to 2 Kings 25, or you can listen with me. In the first 7 verses, we find out exactly what it is. He says this, and in the 9th year of his reign, in the 10th month, on the 10th day, I love the level of detail, of the month, Nebuchadnezzar, we know that name, king of Babylon, came with all his army against Jerusalem and laid siege to it. And they built siege works all around it. So the city was besieged until the 11th year of King Zedekiah. And on the 9th day of the 4th month, the famine was so severe in the city that there was no food for the people of the land. Verse 4, but then a breach was made in the city, and the men of war fled by night by way of the gate between the two walls. So they found a gap in the siege works. They can get out. They ran by the two walls, by the king's garden, through the Chaldeans who were around the city, and they went in the direction of Arabah, which is out to the east. But the army of the Chaldeans pursued the king and overtook him in the plains of Jericho. He made it roughly 20 miles as the bird flies out east. And his army was scattered from him. I mean, these guys are gone. Then they captured the king, Zedekiah, and they brought him up to the king of Babylon at Riblah. And they passed sentence on him. And they slaughtered his sons, the sons of Zedekiah, before his eyes and put out the eyes of Zedekiah. And bound him in chains, and they took him to Babylon. So they did exactly what Micah said that they would do. That they came in, they laid siege, they took out the king, they killed his sons, the last thing he's going to see, because they removed his eyes afterwards. And then they took him off to Babylon. That's how they get sent. It's incredibly violent. This is what Micah is warning them of. But I want you to understand the context of who Micah's hearers are. This is an incredibly comfortable people. They're affluent. They have a relatively peaceful, quaint, quiet existence. No threats. And so to them, they're watching what happens in 722 BC. And what happens in 722, those of you who are Bible scholars, the northern kingdom, right? Assyria comes against them. And of course that happened. Because Yahweh judges the wicked, doesn't he? And their doctrine is not where it should be. So of course God judged them. And so they can sit in Jerusalem and they can look to the north and they can see the smoke. And they go, but that's not happening to us, right? What do we have to worry about? What do we possibly have to worry about? They're telling us to muster our troops. What do we have to worry about? The siege is going to be laid against us. We're in good shape with God. Read back to Micah chapter 3, verse 9, and we'll find out exactly where they were at. He says this, hear this, you heads of the house of Jacob and rulers of the house of Israel who detest justice and make crooked all that is straight, who build Zion with blood and Jerusalem with iniquity. Listen to the charge against their leadership. Its heads give judgment for a bribe. They're paid off. Its priests teach for a price. In other words, they were willing to tell you what you wanted to hear if you paid them enough. Your elders here are not for sale, but here they were. Its prophets practice divination for money, and yet they lean on the Lord. And this is such a statement of like, well, look at the fruit, right? They go, is not the Lord in the midst of us? In other words, because God was still in the temple, they thought everything that they were doing was perfectly fine. Nothing to worry about here. We live this nice, peaceful, quaint life. No mustering troops. God is still in the temple. What do we possibly have to worry about? No disaster shall come upon us. That's how they finish that. They have the safety of the temple. Yeah, God judges the wicked, man. That's what he's doing up in the northern kingdom. What do we possibly have to worry about here in Jerusalem? What do we possibly have to worry about? And yet, God is incredibly worried about them. That's why Micah is here. Because when God looks at how it is that they're living their lives, what was intended for God's people? If you go back to Genesis 12, right? Abrahamic covenant. What was intended for God's people is that they would be an advertisement for who God was. That if they lived the way God intended them to live, if they followed the law, if they lived their lives and conducted themselves in accordance to the Torah, the instruction, the teaching that God had given them, if they could live like that, they would be a blessing not only to themselves, but to all the other nations. All their neighbors would be blessed because they live in such a radically different way that reflects who God is, worshiping Yahweh, not worshiping something else. But they're a horrible shop window, to use Alex's metaphor from week one. They're a horrible shop window. Because what's in their shop window? Well, they worship the same gods as everyone else in their town. Their neighborhood looks just like them because that's exactly what they worship. And so for all of what's happening in their headspace and their doctrine and all of these things that they may or may not confess in the temple about who Yahweh is, who they worship during the week is the exact same gods as their neighbors. There might be something in that for us. We'll come back to that. I want to pause here really quick and just remind us where we're at in the book of Micah before we jump into verse 2, because verse 2 is a swing towards hope. What is possibly going to happen with as people that God has given the rules to over and over ad nauseum? What is possibly going to change that would make this people God's people again? What could possibly change? Because clearly they're not doing it on their own, and they have no desire to worship him. So what could possibly change? Go back, chapter 1 through 3, just to give you a quick flyover synopsis of the book, is when God is introduced as witness and judge, and he lays out the accusation, effectively an indictment against these people, and you see the injustice of their leaders, like I read you in Micah 3, and the corruption of the priests, and the corruption of the prophets. And then in 3b, we learn that the second half of 3, we learn that there's going to be a response to the behavior, that God is going to discipline his people. Excuse me, I'm getting over a head cold, so I need water up here. God is going to discipline his people. There's a difference between punishment and discipline. And I want you to pick that up when you look at the God of the Old Testament and go, that guy's real violent. I want you to recognize that with his people, there's a difference between punishment and discipline. Discipline always seeks to restore. It always seeks to restore. I want you to see God as a good parent with his children who is lovingly not just going to repeat the law for them again, going back, I know this is the 10th, 12th time we've talked to you. Again, what the rules of the house are these things, and you should go back to the rules of the house, but never responding further than that. That's not good parenting. At some point, there's got to be an escalation beyond a conversation. And so God is going to discipline his people. But what he does in this text is he makes it clear, before he's going to discipline them, he makes it clear that I'm going to bring you back. The reason I had Alex read Jeremiah 31 this morning is because I think it's important to remember the restoration side of this. That we're going to talk about going to Babylon. We're going to talk about how difficult it is to live there. I mean, think back to what we read in 2 Kings. This is not an easy transaction. This wasn't, hey guys, we got to get up and walk and go east to Babylon. No, they were taken by force. They were a conquered people who were struggling in famine. Their king just had his eyes ripped out. That's how they're going to Babylon. But God makes sure that they understand that this comes with restoration. And that's why the beginning of 4, he gives us an image of everything restored. He starts to give us an idea of what a new Jerusalem will look like, what it's going to be to have no more war, to sit in peace. Everyone, what does 4:4 say, right? Everyone can sit under their fig leaf or their fig tree and sit in peace. That's the peace you want, a peace that's under God. And then the back half, we learn what it's going to look like to go to Babylon. But now in chapter 5, starting in verse 2, we get to post-exile. This is what's going to happen when they come back. We're not quite at New Jerusalem yet. We're not quite there. But what's going to happen in the meantime? Because again, the record is shoddy for God's people. How are they possibly going to live any differently here? Because again, they've had the rules the whole time. But they don't worship God. So what is possibly going to change? And everything is going to change. And we find out, verse 2, we're going to go to Bethlehem. So it says this, "But you, O Bethlehem Ephratah, who are too little to be among the clans of Judah, from you shall come forth from me one who is to be the ruler in Israel, whose coming forth is from old, from ancient days." It's picking up some Daniel language there, I think. A name that God liked to give himself, the Ancient of Days. There's a reason they call it Bethlehem Ephratah, and that's because this is a real small town. This is like talking about Gold Bar up on US 2. You're going to have to get specific as to where this is at. You're talking like East Snohomish County, like way over there. And so they're getting specific because there was another Bethlehem that was up in Galilee, and he's trying to make it clear. It's like, no, like this Bethlehem, I don't know if you've heard of it, but it's over here. If you go back just to see how insignificant Bethlehem was, if you go into Joshua 15, there's a reading of the 46 cities and towns of the clan of Judah. Bethlehem doesn't even get a mention. And you got to think, like, man, if you were writing this and you're trying to point, like, Jesus is eventually going to come out of Bethlehem, you'd at least find a way to put a footnote in there. It doesn't even make the top 46. It's a slight widening of the road at best. It's not a big town. And yet, out of this least suspected place, this is where the ruler of Israel is going to come from. Out of the house of David, is going to come the ruler. Think about what's being said here. I want you to think of the significance of what the prophets were trying to do. They're listening to God. Remember, the prophecy is not just a prediction of the future. Prophecy is taking what God says through them and communicating it to the people. This is not Nostradamus. They're listening to God. God is giving them a vision, giving them a word, and they're simply communicating it to the people. So Micah doesn't, he's not reading palms or anything like that. He's listening to God, and God is telling him what to say. But think of the shot that God is calling here. I mean, in the 1932 World Series, Babe Ruth called his shot on an 0-2 count and put a ball over the center field wall, 490 feet over the middle of Wrigley Field. In the World Series, it's the stuff legends are made of. It's the stuff legends are made of. And even if you don't like baseball, and I realize we're in Seattle, and after 20 years of not making the playoffs, who's even watching what's happening anymore? They were on strike. But even if you don't watch baseball, everybody knows who Babe Ruth is because he could make moves like that. That's amazing to make a call like that. But think of what God had to pull off here through his prophet Micah. The Assyrian Empire has to come and go, has to take them into exile and bring them back. Eventually, the Greek Empire has to rise and fall. The Romans have to take over. They have to rise, and they have to get a little bit of an imperial spirit and take over down into Judea and all of these lands. And so they're conquering and overseeing the area where Jesus would live, right? Where he would be born. We go through several Caesars, but then we somehow land on Caesar Augustus. And Caesar Augustus is like the CPA type of Caesars. He loves numbers. He would be an Excel spreadsheet master. He loves taxes and he loves numbers. And he says, I'm going to bring about a census. And you're thinking, oh yeah, census, we've got a census like every 10 years. Now he comes up with 14 years. 14 is a real round number, right? Every 14 years I'm going to take this census. Everybody, as part of that census, has to get back to the town where their family of origin is from. Okay? Joseph needs to meet Mary, decide to get engaged or betrothed to one another, so that she ends up following him and going to his hometown, not hers. Because remember, they're from Nazareth. They're not from Bethlehem. They're going to have to journey back to Joseph's hometown and go there. And if you've been pregnant, I've had a wife who's been pregnant. I've definitely not experienced that myself. But you know that like the gestational period is kind of a shot in the dark. Is it 36 weeks? Is it 39 weeks? Is it 40 weeks? Is it going to come late? Is it going to come early? And she's a virgin, so you don't even know when this got started. But somehow, he's going to land this so that the night that they're in Bethlehem is when she's going to go into labor and give birth. So that this kid is not born to his mother in Nazareth, where she's from, but she's born in Bethlehem because of this insane census, because the Romans are occupying and Caesar Augustus, the Excel spreadsheet dude, is in charge. But God knew all of that was going to happen. He knew all of it was going to happen. God is timeless. Remember, he's the Ancient of Days. Of course he knew it was going to happen. Babe Ruth. Whatever, man. Kid stuff. 700 years out, calling a gestational period. Incredible. Verse 3. We got to keep going. Therefore, he shall give them up until the time when she who is in labor has given birth. We already discussed that. Then the rest of his brothers shall return to the people of Israel, and he, the Messiah, shall stand and shepherd his flock in the strength of the Lord and the majesty of the name of the Lord of his God, and they shall dwell secure. For now he shall be great to the ends of the earth, and he shall be their peace. So again, until this ruler comes, you're taken away, you're brought back, but you're going to end up in this peace, and you'll get an image. You'll get an image of what it is to dwell each his own person under the fig tree in a place of peace. Continue in verse 5. It says, when the Assyrian comes into our land and treads in our palaces, then we'll rise against him with 7 shepherds and 8 princes of men. And they shall shepherd the land of Assyria with the sword, and the land of Nimrod at its entrances, and he shall deliver us from the Assyrian, and when he comes into our land and treads within our border, this is the security that he's going to give them. Remember, Jerusalem, pretty solid town. This is no Bethlehem. They got themselves an army. They feel pretty good because, you know, God's in the temple, and they've got a real nice military installation up here too. And so they feel pretty good about where they stand. But he's saying, no longer is that going to be necessary. This phrase, 7 shepherds and 8 princes, if you know anything about Hebrew poetry, they're not quite into rhyming the way we are for our poetry. They're much more into emphasis. And so what they'll do is they'll throw a line out there, and then they'll throw a second line right below it that is emphasizing the first, just to make the point. And so when he talks about the 7 shepherds and then the 8 princes of men, princes of men would have been someone who's anointed or appointed, installed from the people. When he's saying 7 is the number of Hebrew perfection. And so when he says 8, you guys went to public school with me. When he says 8, it's 7 plus 1. It's perfect plus more. And so he's emphasizing like everything that you're going to need is going to be provided for. Okay, land of Nimrod. I think that's worth discussing too. The land, Assyria and the land of Nimrod will be taken over. The land of Nimrod reference is a reference towards general rebellion against God. This would be like calling 1930s, early 1940s Germany the land of Hitler. It's not talking, like you won't find Nimrod on a map. Nimrod's a person. And Nimrod is attached to the Tower of Babel. And the Tower of Babel is this massive rebellion. It's defiance, one of the clearest expressions of defiance towards God. And so this is code language for being hostile towards God. This is what he's trying to get across. It's that Anyone that's hostile to God will be subdued in the end, such that God's people will live in peace, so that they'll be okay. They'll be rescued. Okay, 7, 8, and 9. Again, back to structure. If you read the front end of 7, and I'm just trying to work through these so that if you go back and read through this, you can understand what's being said on the rest of the text. If you look at the beginning of 7, it says, "Then the remnant of Jacob shall be in the midst of many peoples." Okay. And then you get to 8, and you see, "And the remnant of Jacob shall be among the nations in the midst of many peoples." And you're going, huh, these must be tied together in some way. This must have something to do with one another. And if you look at the structure of it, what it's doing is it's describing, it's using the text to describe what God will be like. But it's running these two things in parallel. So listen to what he says in 7. He says, "Then the remnant of Jacob shall be in the midst of many peoples, like dew from the Lord, like showers from the grass on the grass." That's code word for something man cannot make. You cannot control the rain. You cannot control the dew. And this is an agricultural society, so they get real excited when rain shows up, especially in their area of the world. They get real excited, and they know that it comes from God. "Showers on the grass, which delay not for a man, nor wait for the children of man." Okay, so that's good. So they see this idea. One of the parallel ideas is going to be that God is going to be our provider. Not something that we do or earn or anything like that. It's something that God provides. But then we get this lion imagery in 8. Okay, so "And the remnant of Jacob shall be among the nations in the midst of many peoples, like a lion among the beasts of the forest, like a young lion among the flocks of the sheep, which when it goes through, it treads down and tears in pieces, and there is none to deliver them. Your hand shall be lifted over your adversaries, and your enemies shall be cut off." I mean, that's a change in tone, is it not? Is it not? And what he's kind of picking, I think this is where like C.S. Lewis kind of picks up this language, right? When you see God, you know, this imagery of God as lion, it's like he's gentle, but he's not safe, right? It's like this is an incredibly powerful God. Incredibly powerful God. You would be remiss to handle him lightly. He's both gentle, and he's going to take care of his people. And he'll be a conquering lion against those who come against him. Verse 10, "And in that day, declares the Lord, I will cut off your horses from among you, and will destroy your chariots, and I'll cut off the cities of your land, and throw down your strongholds." You're thinking, whoa. Why are you taking all of our stuff? Why are you taking our tanks and nuclear missiles, man? Like, this is what we need to defend ourselves. And they're all references to the military hardware of the day. He's like, you're not going to need your strongholds anymore. You're not going to need your chariots and horses. Like, that's a horrible idea. He's not threatening them. He's just letting them know, it's like, that's not where you want to invest in next year's budget. Because you're not going to need it anymore. I'm going to be there to care for you and protect you. So get rid of all your strongholds. What are you worried about those? And then verse 12, he's going to keep going. He says, "And I'll cut off the sorceries from your hand, and you shall have no more tellers of fortune. And I'll cut off your carved images and your pillars from among you, and you shall bow down no more to the work of your hands. And I will root out your Asherah images from among you and destroy your cities." Asherah is a fertility god. And what he's saying is, he's like, I'm going to get rid of all your sorceries, all your tellers of fortune, all the things that you made. Because all of these idols to other gods are man-made things. Remember the problem with the shop window that God has for the people that Micah is prophesying towards is that they are worshiping other gods. Literally had idols to those gods on their street corners. This is what Jerusalem looked like. This is the people of God. They look exactly like their neighbors. And he's saying, yeah, to be clear, not only am I getting rid of the military hardware, we're also very much getting rid of that. That's definitely not going to be needed here. And the final verse, verse 15, "And in anger and wrath, I will execute vengeance on the nations that did not obey." It's like, just imagine Samuel L. Jackson reading that. In the end, God will practice vengeance. This is not an illegitimate ego trip from a God who is out of control, but rather a legitimate exercise of his sovereignty in order for there to be ultimate peace for his people, in order for them to have no more war, no more famine, no more sickness, no more death, in order for all of that to be the case, God is going to have to practice his vengeance. Not out of ego, but rooted in and motivated by love. That's where he's going. That's where he's going. All right. Good stuff, right? Thanks, Mark. Real nice sermon on the sovereignty of God. God is in control. God is sovereign. I'm going to guess, just, you know, now that I can see your faces this week, most of you could have nailed the Sunday school question on the way in the room as to whether or not God was sovereign. I think you got it. I think you got it. In fact, I think Micah's people got it too. I think they knew it somewhere in the back of their head. From an intellectual, we know he's there. The issue is that their life doesn't reflect that. For all the doctrine they got right, their life looks exactly like their neighbor's. Do you see the disconnect? Think of us, right? We're the American church. We're part of it. We're part of it. We love doctrine. We split over this all the time. Why are there so many denominations of Christian faith in and around the world? Because we nail our doctrine. We make sure we get it exactly right. You sprinkle babies, we're not worshiping with you. We wait till they can profess their faith ourselves and we dunk them completely. We make sure all of our doctrine is lined up. We make sure all of our practices are lined up. But then, to be honest, a lot of us look like our neighbors throughout the week. Worried about the same things. Worshiping the exact same gods they worship. Where do you find your joy, to go back to what Lisa was saying this morning out of her text? Where do you find your joy? Oh, well, it looks a lot like my neighbor. Why did God bother to speak through Micah to say this, that he's sovereign and in control? A good hermeneutic, a good practice of biblical theology, is if you want to understand a text, pull it out of the book for a second. Pull Micah 5 up out of Micah as a whole and see what's missing. Why did he bother to put this here? And consider it, now that you've put it back in, consider it against the whole of Micah. What he's worried about is the example that they're setting for their neighbors. Again, go back to Genesis 12, right? These people are to be a blessing to the nations because they live like God intended them to live. But they're not doing that. They got the headspace right, but they're not actually living that out. And that very much needs to be corrected. When we see it done well, when we see it done well, it's infectious. You guys grew up on Mr. Rogers? For the kids that are in the room, Daniel Tiger was a Presbyterian minister before he was a tiger. Same red coat, or cardigan, forgive me. But Mr. Rogers was a Presbyterian minister who had a heart for kids, and so he came up with a local public TV show to care for kids because there wasn't good programming in his area. He wanted to love his neighborhood because he loved God and he understood that God wanted him more than anything else to be a blessing to his neighborhood. Look how he lived. And people think of Mr. Rogers, like, who wouldn't want, I mean, won't you be my neighbor? I mean, he's the best. He's the best. And why? Because he chose to anchor his life in his theology and live out of that to love his neighbor well. To love his neighbor well. You can seek the welfare of your city, to use the words of Jeremiah 29, and live differently in your city. And I think that's my encouragement to you, is to think through that. But I would be a bad pastor, and my seminary professors would get very upset if I came up here and I told you simply to fix your behavior. And I told you to start living better than you've been living and make better decisions, because don't you know better? They'd be very upset with me, and so would Alex, and so would the other elders. This isn't just about behavior. Why, when we put Micah 5 back into the text, why is he talking about a coming Messiah? Shouldn't we just be worried about point A and point Z? We know we're a sinful people. We know eventually God comes along and does some great stuff, and, you know, there's no more sickness, no more death. It's, just get the revelation. Why this middle step? Oh, because God still wants to bless your neighborhood prior to New Jerusalem. And how are you ever going to do that? How is that ever going to possibly be a thing? You're going to need a new heart. You're going to need a new heart and new desires. And how would that possibly come about? In Bethlehem Ephratah, the Messiah shows up. And he comes and he lives a perfect, sinless life. He shows us what it was to live a life that is aligned with God, to live a life that is wholly human, not enslaved to the idols that are around us in his neighborhood or anything like that. His heart fully directed towards God, and people couldn't get enough of him. He was the ancient Mr. Rogers. He was the better Mr. Rogers, let's be honest. He showed us what it was to live a whole human life. You want to know what it is to find joy in your life? You want to know what it is to finally find satisfaction in your identity? Seattle is so worried about that. And it's right here. It's right here. It's living like Jesus lived. And that's what he intended to show them the whole time. Jesus is the fulfillment of the Abrahamic covenant. He's a blessing to his neighborhood. And so are you, if you lean into him. So he came, he lived this life, but he went to the cross that you could be such that you could be reconciled to God. He died and rose again so that you could be reconciled to God. And then what happens at Pentecost? Right? He kicks it for 40 days with his buds, some very intense seminary discussion about, you know, what just happened here. And then the Holy Spirit is imparted on his church. And his church is born at Pentecost. They get the Holy Spirit. And what happens with the Holy Spirit? New desires, new heart, new all this. So now it's not just about behavior. You've been given a new heart such that you could have new behavior. We saw that as many times as you gave the rules to God's people, Israel, it wasn't going to be sufficient. They were never going to change what they were doing. And so this is the good news of Micah 5. And so the Messiah is going to show up, and it's going to change everything. And that's why we can get rid of the military hardware, and that's why we can get rid of the other gods that you're trying to worship, because Jesus is going to be sufficient, and he's going to draw you into him. And that's exactly what he's invited all of us to, right? Not just a heart, or not just a life of really solid doctrine, where you nail it, and you read Grudem's systematic theology, and you're like, yeah, most of that I would totally agree with. But a lifestyle that reflects Jesus and has a heart for your hood, that's the best. And that's what he intended you to do in the first place. Your best means of evangelism is living a life that is fully rooted in Jesus and living something of what it is to be wholly human, because you're not enslaved to the local idols, but you've tied yourself to him. That's it. All right. I can't end there, because we when Alex and I were looking through the series and figuring out how do we want to tie this all together, because again, Micah means who is a God like this, right? So let's go, as we've done every week, to Micah chapter 7, verse 18, and read that again in light of the gospel, in light of what we've heard here in Micah 5. I love this so much. Who is a God like you? Pardoning iniquity and passing over transgression for the remnant of his inheritance. He doesn't retain his anger forever because he delights in steadfast love. He will again have compassion on us. What good news, man. He will tread our iniquities underfoot. He will cast all our sins into the depths of the sea. You will show faithfulness to Jacob, his people, and steadfast love to Abraham, as you have sworn to our fathers from the day of old. God is faithful, and he loves you. He loves you so much and calls you to love your neighborhood with him, because he loves them too.